Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself. Here on the telephone line near his offices in La Habra, California, is Gene Smith, a bike industry icon and the man behind the widely revered name Cool Stop International. Through Cool Stop, Gene has been outfitting cyclists with high-quality accessories and components for four decades. So how are you doing today, Gene?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing fantastic, Gene. Well, let me ask this question, Gene. You're a long-time, as we spoke at the front end of all this, a long-time industry veteran. How long have you been in the bike business?
About 55 years.
55 years. My God, did you start when you were a kid?
Yep.
Teenager, grade school, or?
No, I wasn't a teenager. I was about 11 years old.
11 years old? My God. You worked at a bike shop in if I understand the notes that I took about our previous conversation, in East Palo Alto. What was the name of that shop, and how old were you?
Well, it was East Palo Alto Bike Shop. It was owned by Art Jansen, and I was, I think, about 11 years old.
11 years old. And Art sold bicycles? Did you sell something else?
Well, we sold bicycles and garden equipment, lawnmowers primarily, but we also sold the tools, the rakes, the hose, and all that stuff.
Huh.
Back in those days, it was pretty tough to just have a bicycle shop. The cycling wasn't what it is today, where a cycle shop can stand on its own 2 feet. Back then, we needed additional revenue to pay the rent.
Huh. So did you work on lawnmowers also?
Oh, yes.
And how did you learn how to do that?
Mr. Jensen taught me.
Okay.
And I taught him how to fix bicycles, so it was a good relationship.
Really? So what was his background? Was he a long-time lawnmower repairman?
No, he was a retired sheet metal worker from Moffett Field.
Uh-huh.
Jensen, I believe he was Danish.
Hmm. Okay.
And his son actually went to high school with me, but he had no interest in the business whatsoever.
Okay. Huh.
Smart guy.
As the saying goes. Now, you moved on. You moved from there at an early age in your career. You moved on to another bike shop?
Right. I went from, in high school, I needed more money because I wanted a car. So Mr. Jensen wasn't able to cough up any more money per hour for me, so I went down and got a job at Smith's on the Circle for $1.25 an hour, which wasn't bad money back then.
Gee, Minnie, what year was that? In the 50s?
It had to be 1954.
My God, you're making $1.25 an hour in 1954.
Well, I was only making 50 cents an hour at East Palo Alto Bike Shop until my mother went over and talked to me. And then I got a whole quarter raise, but I got a two-hour lecture how hard I was going to have to work for that extra quarter.
Uh-huh.
Which,
wow.
I did.
Great. Now, you then, I'm trying to understand, at what point in your evolution did you graduate into your role as a marketer, as a distributor of bike products?
Well, during college, I worked at another bicycle shop in Palo Alto called Midtown Sports Shop. At first, it was owned by Leo Nomolini, and then it was bought by Marge and Chuck White. And then I went down to Taft to go to school there because I was wanting to become either a geologist or a mining engineer. Well, not a mining engineer, but a petroleum engineer.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I worked 2 summers in the oil fields, and that's pretty dirty work. So, and cycling has always been my hobby, so I thought, well, if I got to work, I might as well do something I like to do.
Okay, now you said I'm catching a couple of things. You said Leo Nomolini, that's the X49er, San Francisco 49er?
X49er, yeah.
Great. And Taft.
Okay, when that guy laughed or walked, the merchandise fell off the shelves. That guy was huge.
Really? Wow. And he owned a bike shop in Palo Alto, you say?
He owned a bike shop in Palo Alto called Midtown Sport.
Okay.
I don't know that it exists now, but it was kind of across the street, or up the street, I should say, from Paul's bike shop.
And I guess this was after his career as a 49er?
No, he was still playing.
He was playing football and owned a bike shop at the same time?
Yeah, well,
wow.
He had managers. He was just kind of a, you know, the name.
Huh. You also talked about a, back then you worked for a, in 1954 when you worked for Art Jensen, you also worked for a lock shop as well, a bike and lock shop. Was that?
Well, when I went to work for Smith's on a circle, I was in the cycle and locksmith department of that store. They were a pretty large sporting goods store at that time. Their store took the whole half of the circle on the south side of the circle. So I even learned to pick locks and cut keys and
wow. You were kind of a learning a craft that as a locksmith. Is that still with you? Are you still keen for that type of thing?
Yeah, I liked it.
Can you still pick a lock?
I had my own bike shop. I did lawnmowers and locksmithing as well as bicycles.
Wow. So can you still pick a lock, Gene?
Yeah, I think I can.
Really? Wow.
I haven't had to do that, but I have. Since I stopped doing it, I've had to pick a couple locks.
Okay. Now, what I'm trying to understand is another word that came up for me and what you were just talking about in terms of your education was did you say Taft? T-A-F-T, Taft?
Taft. It's down in the San Joaquin Valley, and it's west of Bakersfield.
And did you get a college degree from Taft?
Well, it's a junior college, or this community college, yes.
Okay. So did you end up with a four-year degree from anywhere?
Nope.
No?
Nope.
So you're a Taft JC grad, huh?
Yeah.
Wow. And so after Taft...
That movie, Best of Times, that Robin Williams did was filmed at Taft. It was about Taft and Bakersfield football team.
Huh.
In fact, okay. I lived across the street from where it was filmed.
God, man. Okay, so now you went from you didn't like working in the oil fields. That wasn't clean work for you.
Well, I didn't mind that, but I didn't want to wind up in Saudi Arabia drilling for oil or South America. That wasn't too appealing.
Huh.
And like I said, I did need work, so I might as well do something I like to do, and I'm still doing it, and I'm still working.
So at what point then did you left Taft and started selling what? What kind of bike products?
Well, I started to work, when I got married in 1958. I worked for, at that time it was called Metal Cyclery. They had a wholesale division of bicycle parts and motorcycle parts. That company was bought up by Rocky Cycle, which is the largest motorcycle distributing company in the United States. They've got probably 5 distribution centers. But I started traveling on the road selling bicycle motorcycle parts, and I decided I'd open my own business up in Reno, and did that for a couple of years. And Reno was a very transit town, and I had an opportunity to go to work for Murray, Ohio, because I knew the guys from Murray, and because they were one of my customers previously. One of their distributors was one of my customers, called the Murray Company, not the Murray Company in San Francisco, but the one in L.A.
Now, when you say Murray, you mean M-U-R-R-A-Y?
Right. Murray, Ohio,
okay.
At that time, was the largest producer of bicycles in the United States.
And that was kind of more the department store bikes, right?
Well, not really, but they were mainly known for that type of sale, because they could produce 600 bikes per hour per line, and it was hard to find a bicycle distributor that could, you know, take on that kind of production.
Oh, jeez. 600 bikes an hour. Wow.
Right. That's from raw steel to carton. They had their own tube mills. They did their own rims. They did all their own welds. They built more of the bike than any manufacturer in the United States even to this day. Murray really doesn't exist as Murray did when I worked for him.
So how did you come into Cool Stop? Where in the scheme of things did that fall into here?
From Murray, I started a company for West Coast Cycle called Bicycle Products Development, and did that for a couple of years, and then it wasn't working out, so I left, and then it's when I formed Cycle Components, which still is in existence, but I became, which was a manufacturing rep firm. We ripped, 10, 12 different manufacturers, and Cool Stop was one of them. And then there was three shareholders in Cool Stop, and one of them wanted to go back to England, so I ended up buying his shares. And that's one of the best things I ever did, because I can't fire myself from my own company.
So how many years have you been doing Cool Stop then?
Cool Stop we've been doing about 33 years.
33 years. Jeez. So you've... You sold lots of products. Why did you stick with Cool Stop? I mean, over the years, you've sold bikes. You've previous, to, of course, I'm talking about previous to Cool Stop. Why Cool Stop?
Well, Cool Stop had a lot to offer to the bicycle industry, and my partner Richard Everett really wasn't familiar with the bicycle industry, but he's a tremendous engineer and can take an idea and really make it fly. So we have our own engineering department there. We have our own tool and die shop there. We actually manufacture our own rubber and mold or blend it and mold our brake pads. We do everything in-house. We're vertically integrated. We're the only company or brake pad manufacturing company in the world that really makes everything. And that was kind of key to our success, because we wanted to come out with a product that would work with anything else on the market, which we did. But it cost more, and it took a while to get people to understand that, you know, you get what you pay for, but if you want better braking, you better put Cool Stop on.
So are yours the best big... Let me pause for one moment here. You said, and you mentioned a name, I think it got garbled in the connection. Did you say Dick Everett? Is that what you were trying to say? Okay, I'm just kind of repeating that because I know what the name is.
Yeah. Dick and I own Cool Stop together, 50-50, and he's really in charge, president of engineering, and I'm president of marketing and sales.
Great. Okay, and manufacturing takes place up in Lake Oswego. Is that correct?
Yeah, right. Lake Oswego, Oregon, which is 10 miles south of Portland.
Okay, and how many people are involved in the production of brake pads up in Oregon?
With office staff down here and up there, it'll vary between 20 and 25.
Okay.
Probably average is around 20.
Now, you say you formulate your own rubber. You also talk about something called a dual compound. Why is that important? Why is a dual compound important?
The dual compound, or multiple compounds that we own worldwide patents to, really let the brake pad perform to the rider's best expectations. And the reason for that is that a pad that's a single compound has a tendency to want to grab the rim the minute it hits the rim. And the best way to explain that is if an airplane was landing on the tarmac or runway and the wheels were traveling at the same speed the plane was landing, you wouldn't get that puff of smoke. Well, with a dual compound, it allows the pad to land on the rim without first grabbing it, and then the brakes apply, and it really eliminates chatter and a squeal, which people don't like. We don't charge for the horn.
Don't charge for the horn.
No.
Excellent. Okay, and. Now, where this compound's concerned, are any other manufacturers of brakes making them in dual compound?
No, they can't, because we have the
patented. Great, excellent. So, now, when you first came out of the gate, you thought about charging $8 a pad, a set. I'm saying, and
they were more than that.
More than eight.
Huh. The first pad we came out with, which was called the International, excuse me, was a round louvered pad, and we were just developing these pads. We really didn't have a name for the company, but to make a brake pad wear longer, you've got to keep it cool.
Uh-huh.
And it's the same with automobile braking or disc brakes or whatnot. If you can keep the pad cool, then it's going to wear longer and work better.
Uh-huh.
So we came out with a pad called International, and it kept cool and it wore good, but it literally retailed for about $20 a pair.
Holy crap.
And that was not acceptable at that time to the consumer or the dealer for that matter, because they were used to selling brake pads for 25 cents a pair. So then we came out with the Continental pad, which was a more traditionally looking brake pad that was molded around a backbone. The backbone happened to be zinc at that time, which also acted as a heat sink, like the International pad. That round fin thing was acting as a heat sink and dissipating the heat away from the pad, which we've had a patent on that for years, but you know that's expired now. But we really changed the way brake pads looked. Everybody now is molding brake pads around a backbone. And that pad was a little more reasonable. That pad retailed for like $3 a pair, maybe $2.50. So people started trying them, and then they actually found out that we did make the brakes work better.
So do you have any competition from offshore? Are there any brake pads out there that can perform?
We got lots of competition. We got lots of competition.
Okay. And
that keeps us on our toes.
Okay. Now, do you spec those brake pads out for? Are there any new bikes that spec your pad as original equipment?
We are specced on a number of upper-end bikes.
Uh-huh.
And we totally make the brake pads in the United States, 100%, and then we ship them to wherever the most of them are in Taiwan right now, but we have sent a few to China.
Huh. So you're actually sending stuff the other way.
Yeah.
Wow.
We're unusual.
No kidding, you are. Man. And I think that where this success is concerned of striving for the highest possible quality you can put underneath your cyclists, that ports over to other industries or other parts of your company. You also sell trailers, and
yeah, we started making a line of trailers. I think we've been doing it for about 18 years, and the reason we made trailers was at the request of our distributors, because all the trailer manufacturers like Burley, Equinox, Blue Sky, we were selling dealer direct, and the trailers were starting to catch on, which was causing the bike-mounted child seats to decline in sales. And the trailer was a nice sale. I mean, they were $300-$400.
Uh-huh.
So we got started with that, and then the same thing with the joggers. We make a line of really sports joggers. Our jogger is probably the most expensive out there, but we're not going to make anything cheap.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now you put
it good. Everything has sealed bearings, stainless steel spokes, stainless steel hardware, and you know it's built. All of our products are built to have longevity and resale value, especially in the resale brake pads, but resale value in the joggers and the trailers. I mean, the person will buy our product and pay $300-$400. And if they take reasonable care of it, they can use it from 3 to 5 years and probably get half the money back, which isn't a bad investment.
Compared to the trailer you can buy, like, for example, from Costco,
I saw a trailer selling at Costco, and I wouldn't put a dog in for $49.99.
Uh-huh.
they will sell them.
And at the end of a couple of years, you've got nothing. You got something that just belongs in the garbage heap, I guess, huh?
Right. Well, you know, those type of products go in the dumpster.
Yeah.
They don't resell. There's nothing left to resell.
Okay, there's something I want to come back to about the brake pads I didn't deliberate upon. You use you don't use injection molding. You use compression molding?
No, No, our material can't be injection molded. It's what they call a process called bulk molding. We had to put loads in the to the dies, the tools, and then it's like a hydraulic press comes down and forms around the backbone.
So each individual pad is made
well,
in this way.
Or? The tools vary in size. I mean, we did everything in 20 to 25 cavity molds, but now we're doing everything in somewhere around 80 to 100 cavities.
Mm-hmm. And so, if you were to do the math, I'm sure you probably figured this out. How long does it take you to make one brake pad, for example?
Well, the cycle time on a tool is about 3.5 minutes.
Uh huh.
So, but then you have to put them in an oven and post cure them for about 45 minutes. You could do it in the tool by letting it cycle longer. You could let the run for maybe up to 8 minutes, and then you wouldn't have to post cure them. But that ties your tool up and causes a gitch in manufacturing or production. We can't get enough out.
Okay, now when you're formulating the rubber, does this find itself under a microscope, like as new materials become available to the industry, or how?
Well, we're constantly testing other materials. We use elastomers along with the rubber for a binder, but it's you have to be awfully careful. Now everybody comes to us for like Zip. We do Zip's brake pads, and we cooperated with them to develop a pad that wouldn't tear those rims apart, because both wheels sell for over $1,000 a wheel.
You're talking about the mags.
Yeah, no, the carbon.
Yeah.
Uh huh. And then we've had like the BMX days, the Skyway wheels, which were fiberglass more or less.
Uh huh.
And you get a pad too hard and it starts tearing the rim apart. You get it too soft and it starts to transfer.
Uh huh.
Which isn't desirable. And then you got to develop a pad that won't tear the rim apart, won't transfer, and still pass CPSC standards.
Okay, now when you say transfer, you mean leave a little bit of deposit?
Well, actually, take the pad and put it on the rim.
Okay, yeah, right, got it. Okay.
It's just like they came out a number of years ago with the ceramic rims.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody could stop those rims.
Yeah.
I don't know why the rim manufacturers don't come to the brake shoe manufacturers and say, hey, this is what we want to do. Can you develop a pad that'll stop?
So
they come out and they just figure everybody's going to be putting disc brakes on. They won't be using rim brakes. There are an awful lot of disc brakes out right now, but there's still a lot of rim brakes out, too.
So let me see if I understand you correctly. So in other words, you cannot put a pad on a ceramic rim.
Oh yeah, we developed one.
You figured one out.
It's a coin name, but we call it Z-Chromium, but it's our green pad, and it works very, very well on ceramic rims.
Okay, Gene. Well, let's talk about the big picture of your company for a second here. As Cool Stuff International, how many different countries do you do business in?
Oh, we do it worldwide. I mean, mm-hmm. Any country that's in cycling, we have a distributor there. It's amazing. We sell brake pads in China, and a lot in Taiwan.
A lot in Taiwan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
okay.
Our biggest market in Europe is Germany, and of course we're in all the European communities there. We even sell brake pads in Russia.
So, and part of your job as the marketing rep for Cool Stuff is you travel the world meeting bike industry people, interfacing with the various people that are working in the industry at trade shows and things like that. How many months out of the year are you at home, Gene?
Well, I travel heavily in the spring and the fall.
Okay.
In the summertime, I travel heavily to the Sierras and go fishing.
Okay. Heavy fishing travel, huh?
Yeah, my Somebody's got to do this stuff.
Okay. Now, when you say that you do trade shows, when I say you do trade shows all over the world, there's of course Interbike. There's the Japan trade shows. There's a German trade show.
Well, the biggest trade shows
Italy
going is well, the, if you really attended Interbike, the Taiwan International Cycle Show, and Eurobike, I think you would really hit who you want to see.
Mm-hmm. And, but you go beyond that. You go to all the sports shows, too, for your baby joggers,
well,
right?
Well, we do the baby shows, or juvenile shows, as they're called. Mm-hmm. But, we, of course, we don't sell brake pads there, but we need to be there for our wheel goods line.
Mm-hmm. Your wheel goods line?
Well, we do tricycles and the strollers, which sell at the, in juvenile stores. They don't really sell any trailers, but we sell all of those lines through bicycle shops, or what we call IBDs, or independent retail dealers. We mm-hmm. don't supply any of the mass merchants or big boxes.
Huh.
And have no desire to either.
Great. Now, when I was researching, that brings me back to a thought I had when I was researching some of the kinds of the overview that I needed to kind of conduct this interview. You talked about in some of the literature about the fact that the IBDs, the independent bike dealers, are a lot focused on trying to be competitive as per what's coming out of from the offshore marketplace. And yet you had some different advice for them. What were you saying?
Well, all the bicycles now really are offshore.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
they're bringing a lot of quality products
right.
out of China and mm-hmm. Taiwan, of course. And there's still a couple of manufacturers here in the United States building high-end bikes. But the IBD is focused on quality, not necessarily trying to be competitive with the big box stores, but quality and service.
Okay, so your advice is to kind of give them the highest quality product?
Well, I happened to go into a Lexus dealer last week, and I'll tell you, I was impressed. And they offer very, very good service, quick, courteous. I mean, and this is, I think, what our independent bicycle dealers, if they're not doing, should do. And if they don't know how to do it, they ought to go visit their Lexus dealer.
Okay, great.
Or Mercedes-Benz. I mean, they got a good reputation for service as well. Cadillac as well. But, you know, they're not selling cheap cars.
So essentially you're saying that in order for the IBD to be competitive, that they've got to focus on giving, be more service-oriented toward the customer.
Well, they have to be knowledgeable of what they're selling.
Uh-huh.
And knowledgeable of why they're asking the price they're asking.
Uh-huh.
What makes it better? You know, you can look at a bike for $300 and look at one for $3,000, and they both have front and rear wheels on, and pedals and handlebars.
Uh-huh.
What's the difference? Where does the $2,700 come in?
Huh. Okay, well, it sounds to me like you have cool stuff. You're able to kind of live in both worlds because you're all about service. You've got the 800 numbers. You've got the email points. Yeah, go ahead.
Service is very important, but quality is, I think, on top, and then you have to follow the quality up with service. And as I tell my guys, I mean, if we have a customer complaint, I want that thing fixed, like, as quick as you can, because you try to turn that negative into a positive as quickly as you can. And the quicker you do it, that really impresses the customer, and they're going to tell their neighbor and their friends and whatnot. And we really bend over backwards to do it. We can't please everybody, but we definitely try, and we even try to please the ones we can't please. But
I'm skipping around here, but there's something that's coming up for me that I want to kind of make sure I underscore, is your trailer line. You make everyone, when they think of single wheel trailers, they think of the Bob, and that just automatically comes up in their mind's eye. And yet, you make two. Is it the Wildebeest and
the Wildebeest is, and we make the Cool Mule.
Yeah,
That trailer sells better in Europe than it did here.
Uh-huh.
The wilder beast, we were about 3 years late in getting it out because we have and still have a better trailer. But the connection was really the problem that we were having, is that we had no way to really hook it to the bike that was going to be satisfactory. And even the Bob has a very poor connection. And if you don't travel with extra skewers, you wish you had, because it's awfully uncomfortable or cumbersome to hang onto that trailer and ride home with it.
Yes.
A skewer doesn't bend it. It just breaks because it's out of, you know, spring steel.
Right, right.
Hardened steel. But our connection now, we have two of them. We can literally fit any bike out there, and we don't rely on the skewer for the connection, and it's a very strong connection. We've had people right around Australia. We have people right clear across the United States with our trailer. But, you know, being late in getting into the marketplace didn't help us in the market. But right now, the Wilder Beast is doing very well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how many different trailers do you have? Is it about eight?
No. Right now we have three, and that's probably going to be cut down to two. I'm talking about child trailers, and then
that's what I mean. Child trailers is about
child trailers and cargo trailers.
Total, all of them.
We have six.
Six trailers. Okay, well, yeah. It was close. Only off by two. Okay, and what I'm trying to understand is why, for example, your Wilder Beast and your, those are killer trailers with a center pull mount and stainless steel. Is that
Well, the trailer is 4130 Kromali, and it's very lightweight. The biggest advantage, I think, that we have over any of our competition, which really is Bob, which stands for Beast of Burden, is that it folds down. And the cargo area is more rectangular. With the Bob, it doesn't fold down, and the cargo area is rounded in the front, so it eats up a lot of the cargo space.
Wow. Okay.
We're the only trailer line in the child trailer manufacturing field that is center pull. Every one of our trailers is center pull, and it really, really, really pull good. The reason that we were all side pull is because that was the best way to pull a trailer. Because the shorter you couple the trailer to the bike, the better it's going to pull. If you try to hook it and center pull it from the off the seat mast, that makes a very long connection, and that trailer's going to want to tend to dictate to the bike where it wants to go. You get used to it. But it oscillates and jumps around all over the place. And then we came up with the connection for the Wilder Beast, and I said, hey, let's just make all our trailer center pull. Mm-hmm. Competition can't do that.
Wow. So when is the competition starting to pick up on that?
They're trying, but, you know, we've got patents on our connection, and Bob has patents on theirs, and we're watching them real closely that they don't infringe. It's very difficult to come up with a connection that's consumer-friendly or user-friendly that they'll want to connect to the bike, and ours is very quick to connect.
So are you finding, Gene, that that people are starting now to kind of your market, is it starting to discover the center pool?
Yeah, they're starting to discover that, hey, this Bob isn't as great as everybody thought it was.
Okay, right, great.
It's a good product. I'm not running the product down at all.
Right.
It's a very good product.
And
it's well made. And it's just that I think our product has more features, and our product actually sells for less money.
Give me a, just for those that are listening, an MSRP for this point in time on your Wilder Beast, for example.
I didn't hear you.
Okay, your suggested retail on the Wilder Beast.
Oh, retail.
Yeah.
With a bag, about $275.
Wow, that's phenomenal. That's phenomenal, and it's high quality. Now, those aren't made here in the States.
No, all of the wheel goods are made offshore. Right now, they're all made in Taiwan.
Okay. Now, is that another place that you travel as well,
yes.
To oversee the production?
Well, not necessarily see the production, but to work on new product.
Okay.
Product,
all right.
Take the product. We do all the product development here in the United States, and then take it to Taiwan.
Okay. Now, are they using?
They will probably have to go to China. I don't like it, but that's the way it goes.
Okay. So now these trailers that are being built in Taiwan, is the quality of metal the same as what would be coming from the States? Is it, or I know that there was like that. There was kind of an issue of the quality of the metal they were using at some point.
Well, the quality would be...
The raw material.
It is good, if not better.
Oh, really? Okay. Huh, okay. All right, so you feel like you're getting as good a trailer?
You made it here, though, you couldn't afford to buy it,
uh-huh.
Which is sad.
Right, right.
That's reality.
Wow. Huh. Jeez. Okay, well, I'm glad that we've kind of gotten a better feel for Cool Style Trailers, because I really feel that's a very strong player in your profile of things that you offer to the consumer. And maybe I should ask, I don't know if it's correct or prudent to ask you, but is the Bob made in the States, or do they go offshore also?
No, they've always, I shouldn't say they always, the first few were made here in the States, but they're all made in Taiwan as well.
Okay, got it. Right. Okay, well, great. Gene, if there were a Hall of Fame for bike industry captains, your name would totally be at the top of the list. Indeed.
Thank you.
You know, we've reached that point in the interview where it's time to ask if there's anything you'd like to add to it.
No.
So you're all good to go, huh?
I'm good to go.
All right.
I'm getting hungry.
Well, listen, tell Sally thanks for letting me use her phone today to reach you, and I hope you have an absolutely wonderful Christmas, and just thanks for the incredible person you've been, and joy has been to talk to you over the years, and we'll talk soon, Gene.
Okay, Martin.
Have a great Christmas, guy.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You just heard Gene Smith of Cool Stop International. You can find Cool Stop brake pads, Cool Stop center pull trailers, their gourmet baby joggers, and their random bike accessory line at coolstop.com. Now that's Cool Stop with a K, KOOLSTOP.com. That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG, go to nationalbicyclegreenway.com. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.